modern society. For the knowledge organization, as we've been learning these last few years, needs both managers and individual professional contributors in positions of responsibility, decision-making, and authority. This fact is perhaps best illustrated by a recent newspaper interview with a young American infantry captain in the Vietnam jungle. Asked by the reporter, "How in this confused situation can you retain command?" the young captain said, "Around here, I am the only guy who is responsible. If these men don't know what to do when they run into an enemy in the jungle, I'm too far away to tell them. My job is to make sure they know. What they do depends on the situation, which only they can judge. The responsibility is always mine, but the decision lies with whoever is on the spot." In a guerrilla war, every man is an executive. There are many managers who aren't executives. Many people, in other words, are superiors of other people, and often of fairly large numbers of other people, and still don't seriously affect the ability of the organization to perform. Most foremen in a manufacturing plant belong here. They're overseers in the literal sense of the word. They're managers in that they manage the work of others, but they have neither the responsibility for nor authority over the direction, the content, and the quality of the work or the methods of its performance. They can still be measured and appraised very largely in terms of efficiency and quality, and by the yardsticks we've developed to measure and appraise the work and performance of the manual worker. Conversely, whether a knowledge worker is an executive doesn't depend on whether he manages people or not. In one business, the market research man may have a staff of 200 people, whereas the market research man of the closest competitor is all by himself and has only a secretary for his staff. This should make little difference in the contribution expected of the two men. It's an administrative detail. 200 people, of course, can do a great deal more work than one man, but it doesn't follow that they produce and contribute more. Knowledge work isn't defined by quantity. Neither is knowledge work defined by its costs. Knowledge work is defined by its results, and for these, the size of the group and the magnitude of the managerial job aren't even symptoms. Having many people working in market research may endow the results with that increment of insight, imagination, and quality that gives a company the potential of rapid growth and success. If so, 200 men are cheap, but it's just as likely that the manager will be overwhelmed by all the problems 200 men bring to their work and cause through their interactions. He may be so busy managing as to have no time for market research and for fundamental decisions. He may be so busy checking figures that he never asks the question, "What do we really mean when we say our market?" And as a result, he may fail to notice significant changes in the market, which eventually may cause the downfall of his company. But the individual market researcher without a staff may be equally productive or unproductive. He may be the source of the knowledge and vision that make his company prosper, or he may spend so much of his time hunting down details, the footnotes academicians so often mistake for research, as to see and hear nothing and to think even less. Throughout every one of our knowledge organizations, we have people who manage no one and yet are executives. Rarely indeed do we find a situation such as that in the Vietnam jungle, where at any moment, any member of the entire group may be called upon to make decisions with life and death impact for the whole. But the chemist in the research laboratory who decides to follow one line of inquiry rather than another one may make the entrepreneurial decision that determines the future of his company. He may be the research director, but he also may be, and often is, a chemist with no managerial responsibilities, if not even a fairly junior man. Similarly, the decision what to consider one product in the account books may be made by a senior vice president in the company. It may also be made by a junior, and this holds true in all areas of today's large organization. I have called executives those knowledge workers, managers, or individual professionals who are expected by virtue of their position or their knowledge to make decisions in the normal course of their work that have significant impact on the performance and results of the whole. They're by no means a majority of the knowledge workers, for in knowledge work too, as in all other areas, there's unskilled work and routine. But they are a much larger proportion of the total knowledge workforce than any organization chart ever reveals. This is beginning to be realized, as witness the many attempts to provide parallel ladders of recognition and reward for managers and for individual professional contributors. What few yet realize, however, is how many people there are even in the most humdrum organization of today, whether business or government agency, research lab or hospital, who have to make decisions of significant and irreversible impact. For the authority of knowledge is surely as legitimate as the authority of position. These decisions, moreover, are of the same kind as the decisions of top management. This was the main point Mr. Kappel was making in the statement we just referred to. The most subordinate manager we now know may do the same kind of work as the president of the company or the administrator of the government agency, that is, plan, organize, integrate, motivate, and measure. His compass may be quite limited, but within his sphere, he's an executive. Similarly, every decision maker does the same kind of work as the company president or the administrator. His scope may be quite limited, but he's an executive even if his function or his name appears neither on the organization chart nor in the internal telephone directory. And whether chief executive or beginner, he needs to be effective. Many of the examples used in this book are taken from the work and experience of chief executives in government, army, hospitals, business, and so on. The main reason is that these are accessible, are indeed often on the public record. Also, big things are more easily analyzed and seen than small ones. But this audiobook itself isn't an audiobook on what people at the top do or should do. It's addressed to everyone who, as a knowledge worker, is responsible for actions and decisions which are meant to contribute to the performance capacity of his organization. It's meant for every one of the men I call executives. Executive realities. The realities of the executive situation both demand effectiveness from him and make effectiveness exceedingly difficult to achieve. Indeed, unless executives work at becoming effective, the realities of their situation will push them into futility. Take a quick look at the realities of a knowledge worker outside an organization to see the problem. A physician has, by and large, no problem of effectiveness. The patient who walks into his office brings with him everything to make the physician's knowledge effective. During the time he's with the patient, the doctor can, as a rule, devote himself to the patient. He can keep interruptions to a minimum. The contribution the physician is expected to make is clear. What's important and what's not is determined by whatever ails the patient. The patient's complaints establish the doctor's priorities, and the goal, the objective, is given. It is to restore the patient to health, or at least to make him more comfortable. Physicians are not noted for their capacity to organize themselves and their work, but few of them have much trouble being effective. The executive in organization is in an entirely different position. In his situation, there are four major realities over which he has essentially no control. Every one of them is built into organization and into the executive's day and work. He has no choice but to cooperate with the inevitable, but every one of these realities exerts pressure toward non-results and non-performance. 1. The executive's time tends to belong to everybody else. If one attempted to define an executive operationally, that is, through his activities, one would have to define him as a captive of the organization. Everybody can move in on his time, and everybody does. There seems to be very little any one executive can do about it. He can't, as a rule, like the physician, stick his head out the door and say to the nurse, "I won't see anybody for the next half hour." Just at this moment, the executive's telephone rings, and he has to speak to the company's best customer or to a high official in the city administration or to his boss, and the next half hour is already gone. 2. Executives are forced to keep on operating unless they take positive action to change the reality in which they live and work. In the United States, the complaint is common that the company president, or any other senior officer, still continues to run marketing or the plant, even though he's now in charge of the whole business and should be giving his time to its direction. This is sometimes blamed on the fact that American executives graduate, as a rule, out of functional work and operations and can't slough off the habits of a lifetime when they get into general management, but exactly the same complaint can be heard in countries where the career ladder is quite different. In the Germanic countries, for instance, a common route into top management has been from a central secretariat, where one works all along as a generalist, yet in German, Swedish, or Dutch companies, top management people are criticized just as much for operating as in the United States. Nor, when one looks at organizations, is this tendency confined to the top. It pervades the entire executive group. There must be a reason for this tendency to operate other than career ladders or even the general perversity of human nature. The fundamental problem is the reality around the executive. Unless he changes it by deliberate action, the flow of events will determine what he's concerned with and what he does. Depending on the flow of events is appropriate for the physician. The doctor who looks up when a patient comes in and says, "Why are you here today?" expects the patient to tell him what's relevant. When the patient says, "Doctor, I can't sleep. I haven't been able to go to sleep the last 3 weeks," He's telling the doctor what the priority area is. Even if the doctor decides upon closer examination that the sleeplessness is a fairly minor symptom of a much more fundamental condition, he'll do something to help the patient to get a few good nights' rest. But events rarely tell the executive anything, let alone the real problem. For the doctor, the patient's complaint is central because it's central to the patient. The executive's concerned with a much more complex universe. What events are important and relevant and what events are merely distractions, the events themselves don't indicate, they're not even symptoms in the sense in which the patient's narrative is a clue for the physician. If the executive lets the flow of events determine what he does, what he works on, and what he takes seriously, he'll fritter himself away operating. He may be an excellent man, but he's certain to waste his knowledge and ability and to throw away what little effectiveness he might have achieved. What the executive needs are criteria which enable him to work on the truly important, that is, on contributions and results, even though the criteria aren't found in the flow of events. 3. The third reality pushing the executive toward ineffectiveness is that he's within an organization. This means that he's effective only if and when other people make use of what he contributes. Organization is a means of multiplying the strength of an individual. It takes his knowledge and uses it as the resource, the motivation, and the vision of other knowledge workers. Knowledge workers are rarely in phase with each other, precisely because they're knowledge workers. Each has his own skill and his own concerns. One man may be interested in tax accounting or in bacteriology or in training and developing tomorrow's key administrators in the city government, but the fellow next door is interested in the finer points of cost accounting and hospital economics or in the legalities of the city charter. Each has to be able to use what the other produces. Usually the people who are most important to the effectiveness of an executive aren't people over whom he has direct control. They're people in other areas, people who in terms of organization are sideways, or they're his superiors. Unless the executive can reach these people, can make his contribution effective for them and in their work, he has no effectiveness at all. 4. Finally, the executive is within an organization. Every executive, whether his organization is a business or a research laboratory, a government agency, a large university, or the Air Force, sees the inside, the organization, as close and immediate reality. He sees the outside only through thick and distorting lenses, if at all. What goes on outside is usually not even known firsthand. It's received through an organizational filter of reports, that is, in an already pre-digested and highly abstract form that imposes organizational criteria of relevance on the outside reality. But the organization is an abstraction. Mathematically, it would have to be represented as a point, that is, as having neither size nor extension. Even the largest organization is unreal compared to the reality of the environment in which it exists. Specifically, there are no results within the organization. All the results are on the outside. The only business results, for instance, are produced by a customer who converts the costs and efforts of the business into revenues and profits through his willingness to exchange his purchasing power for the products or services of the business. The customer may make his decisions as a consumer on the basis of market considerations of supply and demand, or as a socialist government which regulates supply and demand on the basis of essentially non-economic value preferences. In either case, the decision maker is outside rather than inside the business. Similarly, a hospital has results only in respect to the patient, but the patient isn't a member of the hospital organization. For the patient, the hospital is real only while he stays there. His greatest desire is to go back to the non-hospital world as fast as possible. What happens inside any organization is effort and cost. To speak of profit centers in a business, as we are wont to do, is polite euphemism. There are only effort centers. The less an organization has to do to produce results, the better it does its job. That it takes 100,000 employees to produce the automobiles or the steel the market wants is essentially a gross engineering imperfection. The fewer people, the smaller, the less activity inside, the more nearly perfect is the organization in terms of its only reason for existence, the service to the environment. This outside, this environment, which is the true reality, is well beyond effective control from the inside. At the most, results are co-determined, as for instance in warfare, where the outcome is the result of the actions and decisions of both armies. In a business, There can be attempts to mold the customer's preferences and values through promotion and advertising. Except in an extreme shortage situation such as a war economy, the customer still has the final word and the effective veto power, which explains why every communist economy has run into trouble as soon as it moved beyond extreme shortages and long before it reached a position of adequate market supply in which the customer, rather than the political authorities, makes the real and final decisions. But it's the inside of the organization that's most visible to the executive. It's the inside that has immediacy for him. It's relations and contacts, it's problems and challenges, it's cross currents and gossip reach him and touch him at every point. Unless he makes special efforts to gain direct access to outside reality, he'll become increasingly inside focused. The higher up in the organization he goes, the more will his attention be drawn to problems and challenges of the inside rather than to events on the outside. An organization, a social artifact, is very different from a biological organism, yet it stands under the law that governs the structure and size of animals and plants. The surface goes up with the square of the radius, but the mass grows with the cube. The larger the animal becomes, the more resources have to be devoted to the mass and to the internal tasks, to circulation and information, to the nervous system, and so on. Every part of an amoeba is in constant, direct contact with the environment. It therefore needs no special organs to perceive its environment or to hold it together, but a large and complex animal such as man needs a skeleton to hold it together. It needs all kinds of specialized organs for ingestion and digestion, for respiration and exhalation, for carrying oxygen to the tissues, for reproduction, and so on. Above all, a man needs a brain and a number of complex nervous systems. Most of the mass of the amoeba is directly concerned with survival and procreation. Most of the mass of the higher animal, its resources, its food, its energy supply, its tissues, serve to overcome and offset the complexity of the structure and the isolation from the outside. An organization is not, like an animal, an end in itself, and successful by the mere act of perpetuating the species. An organization is an organ of society and fulfills itself by the contribution it makes to the outside environment, and yet, the bigger and apparently more successful an organization gets to be, the more will inside events tend to engage the interests, the energies, and the abilities of the executive to the exclusion of his real tasks and his real effectiveness in the outside. This danger is being aggravated today by the advent of the computer and of the new information technology. The computer, being a mechanical moron, can handle only quantifiable data. These it can handle with speed, accuracy, and precision. It will therefore grind out hitherto unobtainable quantified information in large volume. One can, however, by and large quantify only what goes on inside an organization, costs and production figures, patient statistics in the hospital, or training reports. The relevant outside events are rarely available in quantifiable form until it's much too late to do anything about them. This isn't because our information gathering capacity in respect to the outside events lags behind the technical abilities of the computer. If this were the only thing to worry about, we would just have to increase statistical efforts, and the computer itself could greatly help us to overcome this mechanical limitation. The problem is rather that the important and relevant outside events are often qualitative and not capable of quantification. They're not yet facts. For a fact, after all, is an event which somebody has defined, has classified, and above all, has endowed with relevance. To be able to quantify, one has to have a concept first. One first has to abstract from the infinite welter of phenomena a specific aspect which one can then name and finally count. The thalidomide tragedy which led to the birth of so many deformed babies is a case in point. By the time doctors on the European continent had enough statistics to realize that the number of deformed babies born was significantly larger than normal, so much larger that there had to be a specific and new cause, the damage had been done. In the United States, the damage was prevented because one public health physician perceived a qualitative change, a minor and by itself meaningless skin tingling caused by the drug, related it to a totally different event that happened many years earlier, and sounded the alarm before thalidomide actually came into use. The Ford Edsel holds a similar lesson. All the quantitative figures that could possibly be obtained were gathered before the Edsel was launched. All of them pointed to its being the right car for the right market. The qualitative change, the shifting of American consumer buying of automobiles from income-determined to taste-determined market segmentation, no statistical study could possibly have shown. By the time this could be captured in numbers, it was too late. The Edsel had been brought out and had failed. The truly important events on the outside aren't the trends. They're changes in the trends. These determine ultimately success or failure of an organization and its efforts. Such changes, however, have to be perceived. They can't be counted, defined, or classified. The classifications still produce the expected figures as they did for Edsel, but the figures no longer correspond to actual behavior. The computer is a logic machine, and that's its strength, but also its limitation. The important events on the outside can't be reported in the kind of form a computer or any other logic system could possibly handle. Man, however, while not particularly logical, is perceptive, and that's his strength. The danger is that executives will become contemptuous of information and stimulus that can't be reduced to computer logic and computer language. Executives may become blind to everything that is perception, i.e. event, rather than fact, i.e. after the event. The tremendous amount of computer information may thus shut out access to reality. Eventually, the computer, potentially by far the most useful management tool, should make executives aware of their insulation and free them for more time on the outside. In the short run, however, there's danger of acute computeritis. It's a serious affliction. The computer only makes visible a condition that existed before it. Executives of necessity live and work within an organization. Unless they make conscious efforts to perceive the inside may blind them to the true reality. These four realities the executive can't change. They're necessary conditions of his existence, but he must therefore assume that he'll be ineffectual unless he makes special efforts to learn to be effective. The promise of effectiveness. Increasing effectiveness may well be the only area where we can hope significantly to raise the level of executive performance, achievement, and satisfaction. We certainly could use people of much greater abilities in many places. We could use people of broader knowledge. I submit, however, that in these two areas, not too much can be expected from further efforts. We may be getting to the point where we're already attempting to do the inherently impossible, or at least the inherently unprofitable, but we're not going to breed a new race of supermen. We'll have to run our organizations with men as they are. The books on manager development, for instance, envisage truly a man for all seasons in their picture of the manager of tomorrow. A senior executive, we're told, should have extraordinary abilities as an analyst and as a decision maker. He should be good at working with people and at understanding organization and power relations, be good at mathematics, and have artistic insights and creative imagination. What seems to be wanted is universal genius, and universal genius has always been in scarce supply. The experience of the human race indicates strongly that the only person in abundant supply is the universal incompetent. We'll therefore have to staff our organizations with people who at best excel in one of these abilities, and then they're more likely to lack any but the most modest endowment in the others. We'll have to learn to build organizations in such a manner that any man who has strength in one important area is capable of putting it to work, as will be discussed in considerable depth in Chapter 4. But we cannot expect to get the executive performance we need by raising our standards for abilities, let alone by hoping for the universally gifted man. We'll have to extend the range of human beings through the tools they have to work with, rather than through a sudden quantum jump in human ability. The same more or less applies to knowledge. However badly we may need people of more and better knowledge, the effort needed to make the major improvement may well be greater than any possible, let alone any probable, return. 15 years ago, when operations research first came in, several of the brilliant young practitioners published their prescription for the operations researcher of tomorrow. They always came out asking for a polymath, knowing everything and capable of doing superior and original work in every area of human knowledge. According to one of these studies, operations researchers needed to have advanced knowledge in 62 or so major scientific and humanistic disciplines. If such a man could be found, he would, I am afraid, be totally wasted on studies of inventory levels or on the programming of production schedules. Much less ambitious programs for manager development call for high knowledge in such a host of divergent skills as accounting and personnel, marketing, pricing, and economic analysis, the behavioral sciences such as psychology, and the natural sciences from physics to biology and geology, and we surely need men who understand the dynamics of modern technology, the complexity of the modern world economy, and the labyrinth of modern government. Every one of these is a big area, is indeed too big even for men who work on nothing else. The scholars tend to specialize in fairly small segments of each of these fields, and don't pretend to have more than a journeyman's knowledge of the field itself. I'm not saying that one need not try to understand the fundamentals of every one of these areas. One of the weaknesses of young, highly educated people today, whether in business, medicine, or government, is that they're satisfied to be versed in one narrow specialty and affect a contempt for the other areas. One need not know in detail what to do with human relations as an accountant or how to promote a new branded product if an engineer, but one has a responsibility to know at least what these areas are about, why they're around, and what they're trying to do. One need not know psychiatry to be a good urologist, but one had better know what psychiatry is all about. One need not be an international lawyer to do a good job in the Department of Agriculture, but one had better know enough about international politics not to do international damage through a parochial farm policy. This, however, is something very different from the universal expert, who is as unlikely to occur as the universal genius. Instead, we'll have to learn how to make better use of people who are good in any one of these areas, but this means increasing effectiveness. If one cannot increase the supply of a resource, one must increase its yield, and effectiveness is the one tool to make the resources of ability and knowledge yield more and better results. Effectiveness thus deserves higher priority because of the needs of organization. It deserves even greater priority as the tool of the executive and as his access to achievement and performance. But can effectiveness be learned? If effectiveness were a gift people were born with, the way they're born with a gift for music or an eye for painting, we'd be in bad shape, for we know that only a small minority is born with great gifts in any one of these areas. We'd therefore be reduced to trying to spot people with high potential of effectiveness early and to train them as best we know to develop their talent, but we could hardly hope to find enough people for the executive tasks of modern society this way. Indeed, if effectiveness were a gift, our present civilization would be highly vulnerable if not untenable. As a civilization of large organizations, it's dependent on a large supply of people capable of being executives with a modicum of effectiveness. If effectiveness can be learned, however, the questions arise, what does it consist in? What does one have to learn? Of what kind is the learning? Is it a knowledge, and knowledge one learns in systematic form and through concepts? Is it a skill which one learns as an apprentice, or is it a practice which one learns through doing the same elementary things over and over again? I've been asking these questions for a good many years. As a consultant, I work with executives in many organizations. Effectiveness is crucial to me in two ways. First, a consultant who by definition has no authority other than that of knowledge must himself be effective, or else he's nothing. Second, the most effective consultant depends on people within the client organization to get anything done. Their effectiveness, therefore, determines in the last analysis whether a consultant contributes and achieves results, or whether he's pure cost center, or at best a court jester. I soon learned that there's no effective personality. The effective executives I've seen differ widely in their temperaments and their abilities, in what they do and how they do it, in their personalities, their knowledge, their interests, in fact, in almost everything that distinguishes human beings. All they have in common is the ability to get the right things done. Among the effective executives I've known and worked with, there are extroverts and aloof, retiring men, some even morbidly shy. Some are eccentrics, others painfully correct conformists. Some are fat and some are lean. Some are worriers, some are relaxed. Some drink quite heavily, others are total abstainers. Some are men of great charm and warmth. Some have no more personality than a frozen mackerel. There are a few men among them who would answer to the popular conception of a leader, but equally, there are colorless men who would attract no attention in a crowd. Some are scholars and serious students, others almost unlettered. Some have broad interests, others know nothing except their own narrow area and care for little else. Some of the men are self-centered, if not indeed selfish, but there are also some who are generous of heart and mind. There are men who live only for their work, and others whose main interests lie outside, in community work, in their church, in the study of Chinese poetry, or in modern music. Among the effective executives I've met, there are people who use logic and analysis, and others who rely mainly on perception and intuition. There are men who make decisions easily, and men who suffer agonies every time they have to move. Effective executives, in other words, differ as widely as physicians, high school teachers, or violinists. They differ as widely as do ineffectual ones, are indeed indistinguishable from ineffectual executives in type, personality, and talents. But all these effective executives have in common is the practices that make effective whatever they have and whatever they are, and these practices are the same whether the effective executive works in a business or in a government agency, as hospital administrator, or as university dean. But whenever I've found a man, no matter how great his intelligence, his industry, his imagination, or his knowledge, who fails to observe these practices, I've also found an executive deficient in effectiveness. Effectiveness, in other words, is a habit, that is, a complex of practices, and practices can always be learned. Practices are simple, deceptively so. Even a 7-year-old has no difficulty in understanding a practice, but practices are always exceedingly hard to do well. They have to be acquired, as we all learn the multiplication table, that is, repeated ad nauseam until 6 times 6 equals 36 has become unthinking, conditioned reflex and firmly ingrained habit. Practices one learns by practicing and practicing and practicing again. To every practice applies what my old piano teacher said to me in exasperation when I was a small boy. You will never play Mozart the way Arthur Schnabel does, but there is no reason in the world why you should not play your scales the way he does. What the piano teacher forgot to add, probably because it was so obvious to her, is that even the great pianists could not play Mozart as they do unless they practiced their scales and kept on practicing them. There is, in other words, no reason why anyone with normal endowment shouldn't acquire competence in any practice. Mastery might well elude him, for this one might need special talents, but what is needed in effectiveness is competence. What is needed are the scales. Let me share with you essentially 5 such practices, 5 such habits of the mind that have to be acquired to be an effective executive. 1. Effective executives know where their time goes. They work systematically at managing the little of their time that can be brought under their control. 2. Effective executives focus on outward contribution. They gear their efforts to results rather than to work. They start out with the question, what results are expected of me, rather than with the work to be done, let alone with its techniques and tools. 3. Effective executives build on strengths, their own strengths, the strengths of their superiors, colleagues, and subordinates, and on the strengths in the situation, that is, on what they can do. They don't build on weakness. They don't start out with the things they can't do. 4. Effective executives concentrate on the few major areas where superior performance will produce outstanding results. They force themselves to set priorities and stay with their priority decisions. They know that they have no choice but to do first things first and second things not at all. The alternative is to get nothing done. And 5. Effective executives finally make effective decisions. They know that this is, above all, a matter of system, of the right steps in the right sequence. They know that an effective decision is always a judgment based on dissenting opinions rather than on consensus on the facts, and they know that to make many decisions fast means to make the wrong decisions. What's needed are few but fundamental decisions. What's needed is the right strategy rather than razzle-dazzle tactics. These are the elements of executive effectiveness, and these are the subjects of this audiobook. Chapter 2. Know Thy Time. Most discussions of the executive's task start with the advice to plan one's work. This sounds eminently plausible. The only thing wrong with it is that it rarely works. The plans always remain on paper, always remain good intentions. They seldom turn into achievement. Effective executives, in my observation, don't start with their tasks. They start with their time, and they don't start out with planning. They start by finding out where their time actually goes, then they attempt to manage their time and to cut back unproductive demands on their time. Finally, they consolidate their discretionary time into the largest possible continuing units. This three-step process is as follows. Recording time, managing time, and consolidating time is the foundation of executive effectiveness. Effective executives know that time is the limiting factor. The output limits of any process are set by the scarcest resource. In the process we call accomplishment, this is time. Time is also a unique resource. Of the other major resources, money is actually quite plentiful. We long ago should have learned that it is the demand for capital rather than the supply thereof which sets the limit to economic growth and activity. People, the third limiting resource, one can hire, though one can rarely hire enough good people, but one cannot rent, hire, buy, or otherwise obtain more time. The supply of time is totally inelastic. No matter how high the demand, the supply won't go up. There's no price for it and no marginal utility curve for it. Moreover, time is totally perishable and can't be stored. Yesterday's time is gone forever and will never come back. Time is therefore always in exceedingly short supply. Time is totally irreplaceable. Within limits, we can substitute one resource for another, copper for aluminum, for instance. We can substitute capital for human labor. We can use more knowledge or more brawn, but there's no substitute for time. Everything requires time. It's the one truly universal condition. All work takes place in time and uses up time. Yet most people take for granted this unique, irreplaceable, and necessary resource. Nothing else perhaps distinguishes effective executives as much as their tender, loving care of time. Man is ill-equipped to manage his time. Though man, like all living beings, has a biological clock, as anyone discovers who crosses the Atlantic by jet, he lacks a reliable time sense, as psychological experiments have shown. People kept in a room in which they can't see light and darkness outside rapidly lose all sense of time. Even in total darkness, most people retain their sense of space, but even with the lights on, a few hours in a sealed room make most people incapable of estimating how much time has elapsed. They're as likely to underrate grossly the time spent in the room as to overrate it grossly. If we rely on our memory, therefore, we don't know how time has been spent. I sometimes ask executives who pride themselves on their memory to put down their guesses to how they spend their own time. Then I lock these guesses away for a few weeks or months. In the meantime, the executives run an actual time record on themselves. There's never much resemblance between the way these men thought they used their time and their actual records. One company chairman was absolutely certain that he divided his time roughly into three parts. One-third he thought he was spending with his senior men, one-third he thought he spent with his important customers, and one-third he thought was devoted to community activities. The actual record of his activities over 6 weeks brought out clearly that he spent almost no time in any of these areas. These were the tasks on which he knew he should spend time, and therefore memory, obliging as usual, told him that these were the tasks on which he actually had spent his time. The record showed, however, that he spent most of his hours as a kind of dispatcher, keeping track of orders from customers he personally knew and bothering the plant with telephone calls about them. Most of these orders were going through all right anyhow, and his intervention could only delay them, but when his secretary first came in with the time record, he didn't believe her. It took two or three more time logs to convince him that record, rather than memory, has to be trusted when it comes to the use of time. The effective executive therefore knows that to manage his time, he first has to know where it actually goes. The time demands on the executive. There are constant pressures toward unproductive and wasteful time use. Any executive, whether he's a manager or not, has to spend a great deal of his time on things that don't contribute at all. Much is inevitably wasted. The higher up in the organization he is, the more demands on his time will the organization make.
The head of a large company once told me that in 2 years as chief executive officer, he had eaten out every evening except on Christmas Day and New Year's Day. All the other dinners were official functions, each of which wasted several hours, yet he saw no possible alternative. Whether the dinner honored an employee retiring after 50 years of service or the governor of one of the states in which the company did business, the chief executive officer had to be there. Ceremony is one of his tasks. My friend had no illusions that these dinners contributed anything either to the company or to his own entertainment or self-development, yet he had to be there and dine graciously.
Similar time wasters abound in the life of every executive. When a company's best customer calls up, the sales manager can't say, "I'm busy." He has to listen, even though all the customer wants to talk about may be a bridge game the preceding Saturday or the chances of his daughter's getting into the right college.
The hospital administrator has to attend the meetings of every one of his staff committees, or else the physicians, the nurses, the technicians, and so on feel that they're being slighted. The government administrator had better pay attention when a congressman calls and wants some information he could in less time get out of the telephone book or the World Almanac, and so it goes all day long. Non-managers are no better off. They too are bombarded with demands on their time which add little, if anything, to their productivity and yet can't be disregarded. In every executive job, a large part of the time must therefore be wasted on things which, though they apparently have to be done, contribute nothing or little. Yet most of the tasks of the executive require, for minimum effectiveness, a fairly large quantum of time. To spend in one stretch less than this minimum is sheer waste. One accomplishes nothing and has to begin all over again. To write a report may, for instance, require 6 or 8 hours at least for the first draft. It's pointless to give 7 hours to the task by spending 15 minutes twice a day for 3 weeks. All one has at the end is blank paper with some doodles on it. But if one can lock the door, disconnect the telephone, and sit down to wrestle with a report for 5 or 6 hours without interruption, one has a good chance to come up with what I call a zero draft, the one before the first draft. From then on, one can indeed work in fairly small installments, can rewrite, correct, and edit section by section, paragraph by paragraph, sentence by sentence. The same goes for an experiment. One simply has to have 5 to 12 hours in a single stretch to set up the apparatus and to do at least one completed run, or one has to start all over again after an interruption. To be effective, every knowledge worker, and especially every executive, therefore needs to be able to dispose of time in fairly large chunks. To have small dribs and drabs of time at his disposal won't be sufficient, even if the total is an impressive number of hours. This is particularly true with respect to time spent working with people, which is, of course, a central task in the work of the executive. People are time consumers, and most people are time wasters. To spend a few minutes with people is simply not productive. If one wants to get anything across, one has to spend a fairly large minimum quantum of time. The manager who thinks he can discuss the plans, direction, and performance of one of his subordinates in 15 minutes, and many managers believe this, is just deceiving himself. If one wants to get to the point of having an impact, one needs probably at least an hour, and usually much more. And if one wants to establish a human relationship, one needs infinitely more time. Relations with other knowledge workers are especially time-consuming. Whatever the reason, whether it's the absence of the barrier of class and authority between superior and subordinate in knowledge work, or whether he simply takes himself more seriously, the knowledge worker makes much greater time demands than the manual worker on his superior as well as on his associates. Moreover, because knowledge work can't be measured the way manual work can, one can't tell a knowledge worker in a few simple words whether he's doing the right job and how well he's doing it. One can say to a manual worker, "Our work standard calls for 50 pieces an hour and you're only turning out 42. One has to sit down with a knowledge worker and think through with him what should be done and why before one can even know whether he's doing a satisfactory job or not, and this is time-consuming. Since the knowledge worker directs himself, he must understand what achievement is expected of him and why. He must also understand the work of the people who have to use his knowledge output. For this, he needs a good deal of information, discussion, instruction, all things that take time, and contrary to common belief, this time demand is made not only on his superior, but equally on his colleagues. The knowledge worker must be focused on the results and performance goals of the entire organization to have any results and performance at all. This means that he has to set aside time to direct his vision from his work to results and from his specialty to the outside, in which alone performance lies. Wherever knowledge workers perform well in large organizations, senior executives take time out on a regular schedule to sit down with them, sometimes all the way down to green juniors, and ask, "What should we at the head of this organization know about your work? What do you want to tell me regarding this organization? Where do you see opportunities we don't exploit? Where do you see dangers to which we're still blind? And altogether, what do you want to know from me about the organization?" This leisurely exchange is needed equally in a government agency and in a business, in a research lab and in an army staff. Without it, the knowledge people either lose enthusiasm and become time servers, or they direct their energies toward their specialty and away from the opportunities and needs of the organization. But such a session takes a great deal of time, especially as it should be unhurried and relaxed. People must feel that we have all the time in the world. This actually means that one gets a great deal done fast, but it means also that one has to make available a good deal of time in one chunk and without too much interruption. Mixing personal relations and work relations is time-consuming. If hurried, it turns into friction, yet any organization rests on this mixture. The more people are together, the more time will their sheer interaction take, the less time will be available to them for work, accomplishment, and results. Management literature has long known the theorem of the span of control, which asserts that one man can manage only a few people if these people have to come together in their own work, that is, for instance, an accountant, a sales manager, and a manufacturing man, all three of whom have to work with each other to get any results. On the other hand, managers of chain stores in different cities don't have to work with each other, so that any number could conceivably report to one regional vice president without violating the principle of the span of control. Whether this theorem is valid or not, there's little doubt that the more people have to work together, the more time will be spent on interacting rather than on work and accomplishment. Large organization creates strength by lavishly using the executive's time. The larger the organization, therefore, the less actual time will the executive have. The more important will it be for him to know where his time goes and to manage the little time at his disposal. The more people there are in an organization, the more often does a decision on people arise, but fast personnel decisions are likely to be the wrong decisions. The time quantum of the good personnel decision is amazingly large. What the decision involves often becomes clear only when one has gone around the same track several times. Among the effective executives I've had occasion to observe, there have been people who make decisions fast and people who make them rather slowly, but without exception, they make personnel decisions slowly and they make them several times before they really commit themselves. Alfred P. Sloan, Jr., former head of General Motors, the world's largest manufacturing company, was reported never to make a personnel decision the first time it came up. He made a tentative judgment, and even that took several hours as a rule. Then, a few days or weeks later, he tackled the question again as if he had never worked on it before. Only when he came up with the same name two or three times in a row was he willing to go ahead. Sloan had a deserved reputation for the winners he picked, but when asked about his secret, he's reported to have said, "No secret. I have simply accepted that the first name I come up with is likely to be the wrong name, and I therefore retrace the whole process of thought and analysis a few times before I act." Yet Sloan was far from a patient man. Few executives make personnel decisions of such impact, but all effective executives I've had occasion to observe have learned that they have to give several hours of continuous and uninterrupted thought to decisions on people if they hope to come up with the right answer. The director of a medium-sized government research institute found this out when one of his senior administrators had to be removed from his job. The man was in his 50s and had been with the institute all his working life. After years of good work, the man suddenly began to deteriorate. He clearly could no longer handle his job, but even if civil service rules had permitted it, the man couldn't be fired. He could, of course, have been demoted, but this, the director felt, would destroy the man, and the institute owed him consideration and loyalty for years of productive, loyal service. Yet he couldn't be kept in an administrative position. His shortcomings were much too obvious and were indeed weakening the whole institute. The director and his deputy had been over this situation many times without seeing a way out, but when they sat down for a quiet evening where they could give 3 or 4 hours uninterruptedly to the problem, the obvious solution finally emerged. It was indeed so simple that neither could explain why he had not seen it before. It got the man out of the wrong job into a job which needed being done, and which yet did not require the administrative performance he was no longer able to give. Time in large, continuous, and uninterrupted units is needed for such decisions as whom to put on a task force set up to study a specific problem, what responsibilities to entrust to the manager of a new organizational unit or to the new manager of an old organizational unit, whether to promote into a vacancy a man who has the marketing knowledge needed for the job but lacks technical training, or whether to put in a first-rate technical man without much marketing background, and so on. People decisions are time-consuming, for the simple reason that the Lord didn't create people as resources for organization. They don't come in the proper size and shape for the tasks that have to be done in organization, and they can't be machined down or recast for these tasks. People are always almost fits at best. To get the work done with people and no other resources available, therefore requires lots of time, thought, and judgment. The Slavic peasant of Eastern Europe used to have a proverb, "What one does not have in one's feet, one's got to have in one's head." This may be considered a fanciful version of the law of the conservation of energy, but it's above all something like a law of the conservation of time. The more time we take out of the task of the legs, that is, of physical manual work, the more we'll have to spend on the work of the head, that is, on knowledge work. The easier we make it for rank-and-file workers, machine tenders as well as clerks, the more will have to be done by the knowledge worker. One cannot take knowledge out of the work. It has to be put back somewhere, and in much larger and cohesive amounts. Time demands on the knowledge workers aren't going down. Machine tenders now only work 40 hours a week, and soon may work only 35 and live better than anybody ever lived before, no matter how much he worked or how rich he was. But the machine tender's leisure is inescapably being paid for by the knowledge worker's longer hours. It's not the executives who have a problem of spending their leisure time in the industrial countries of the world today. On the contrary, they are working everywhere longer hours and have greater demands on their time to satisfy, and the executive time scarcity is bound to become worse rather than better. One important reason for this is that a high standard of living presupposes an economy of innovation and change, but innovation and change make inordinate time demands on the executive. All one can think and do in a short time is to think what one already knows and to do as one has always done. There's been an enormous amount of discussion lately to explain why the British economy has lagged so badly since World War II. One of the reasons is surely that the British businessmen of the older generation tried to have it as easy as his workers and to work the same short hours. But this is possible only if the business or the industry clings to the old established routine and shuns innovation and change. For all these reasons, the demands of the organization, the demands of people, the time demands of change and innovation, it will become increasingly important for executives to be able to manage their time. But one cannot even think of managing one's time unless one first knows where it goes. Time diagnosis. That one has to record time before one can know where it goes and before, in turn, one can attempt to manage it, we've realized for the best part of a century. That is, we've known this in respect to manual work, skilled and unskilled, since scientific management around 1900 began to record the time it takes for a specific piece of manual work to be done. Hardly any country is today so far behind in industrial methods as not to time systematically the operations of manual workers. We have applied this knowledge to the work where time doesn't greatly matter, that is, where the difference between time use and time waste is primarily efficiency and costs, but we haven't applied it to the work that matters increasingly, and that particularly has to cope with time, the work of the knowledge worker, and especially of the executive. Here the difference between time use and time waste is effectiveness and results. The first step toward executive effectiveness is therefore to record actual time use. The specific method in which the record is put together need not concern us here. There are executives who keep such a time log themselves. Others, such as the company chairman just mentioned, have their secretaries do it for them. The important thing is that it gets done and that the record is made in real time, that is, at the time of the event itself, rather than later on from memory. A good many effective executives keep such a log continuously and look at it regularly every month. At a minimum, effective executives have the log run on themselves for 3 to 4 weeks at a stretch, twice a year or so, on a regular schedule. After each such sample, they rethink and rework their schedule, but 6 months later, they invariably find that they have drifted into wasting their time on trivia. Time use does improve with practice, but only constant efforts at managing time can prevent drifting. Systematic time management is therefore the next step. One has to find the non-productive, time-wasting activities and get rid of them if one possibly can. This requires asking oneself a number of diagnostic questions. 1. First, one tries to identify and eliminate the things that need not be done at all, the things that are purely waste of time without any results whatever. To find these time wastes, one asks of all activities in the time records, what would happen if this weren't done at all? And if the answer is nothing would happen, then obviously the conclusion is to stop doing it. It's amazing how many things busy people are doing that never will be missed. There are, for instance, the countless speeches, dinners, committee memberships, and directorships, which take an unconscionable toll of the time of busy people, which are rarely enjoyed by them or done well by them, but which are endured year in and year out as an Egyptian plague ordained from on high. Actually,
All one has to do is to learn to say no if an activity contributes nothing to one's own organization, to oneself, or to the organization for which it's to be performed.
The chief executive I was talking about, who had to dine out every night, found, when he analyzed these dinners, that at least one-third would proceed just as well without anyone from the company's senior management. In fact, he found, somewhat to his chagrin, that his acceptance of a good many of these invitations was by no means welcome to his hosts. They had invited him as a polite gesture, but they had fully expected to be turned down and didn't quite know what to do with him when he accepted. I have yet to see an executive, regardless of rank or station, who couldn't consign something like a quarter of the demands on his time to the waste paper basket without anybody's noticing their disappearance. 2. The next question is, which of the activities on my time log could be done by somebody else just as well, if not better? The dinner-eating company chairman found that any senior executive of the company would do for another third of the formal dinners. All the occasion demanded was the company's name on the guest list.
There has been for years a great deal of talk about delegation in management. Every manager, whatever the organization, business, government, university, or armed service, has been exhorted to be a better delegator. In fact, most managers in large organizations have themselves given this sermon, and more than once. I have yet to see any results from all this preaching. The reason why no one listens is simple. As usually presented, delegation makes little sense. If it means that somebody else ought to do part of my work, it's wrong. One is paid for doing one's own work, and if it implies, as the usual sermon does, that the laziest manager is the best manager, it's not only nonsense, it's immoral. But I have never seen an executive confronted with his time record who didn't rapidly acquire the habit of pushing at other people everything that he need not do personally. The first look at the time record makes it abundantly clear that there just isn't time enough to do the things the executive himself considers important, himself wants to do, and is himself committed to doing. The only way he can get to the important things is by pushing on others anything that can be done by them at all. A good example is executive travel. Professor C. Northcote Parkinson has pointed out in one of his delightful satires that the quickest way to get rid of an inconvenient superior is to make a world traveler out of him. The jet plane is indeed overrated as a management tool. A great many trips have to be made, but a junior can make most of them. Travel is still a novelty for him. He's still young enough to get a good night's rest in hotel beds. The junior can take the fatigue, and he'll therefore also do a better job than the more experienced, perhaps better trained, but tired superior. There are also the meetings one attends, even though nothing is going to happen that someone else couldn't handle. There are the hours spent discussing a document before there's even a first draft that can be discussed. There's, in the research lab, the time spent by a senior physicist to write a popular news release on some of his work. Yet there are plenty of people around with enough science to understand what the physicist is trying to say, who can write readable English, where the physicist only speaks higher mathematics. Altogether, an enormous amount of the work being done by executives is work that can easily be done by others, and therefore should be done by others. Delegation, as the term is customarily used, is a misunderstanding, is indeed misdirection. But getting rid of anything that can be done by somebody else so that one does not have to delegate, but can really get to one's own work, that's a major improvement in effectiveness. 3. A common cause of time waste is largely under the executive's control and can be eliminated by him. That's the time of others he himself wastes. There's no one symptom for this, but there's still a simple way to find out. That's to ask other people. Effective executives have learned to ask systematically and without coyness, "What do I do that wastes your time without contributing to your effectiveness?" To ask this question and to ask it without being afraid of the truth is a mark of the effective executive. The manner in which an executive does productive work may still be a major waste of somebody else's time. The senior financial executive of a large organization knew perfectly well that the meetings in his office wasted a lot of time. This man asked all his direct subordinates to every meeting, whatever the topic. As a result, the meetings were far too large, and because every participant felt that he had to show interest, everybody asked at least one question, most of them irrelevant. As a result, the meetings stretched on endlessly, but the senior executive hadn't known until he asked that his subordinates too considered the meetings a waste of their time. Aware of the great importance everyone in the organization placed on status and on being in the know, he had feared that the uninvited men would feel slighted and left out.
Now, however, he satisfies the status needs of his subordinates in a different manner. He sends out a printed form which reads, I have asked Messrs. Smith, Jones, and Robinson to meet with me Wednesday at 3 in the fourth floor conference room to discuss next year's capital appropriations budget, for example. Please come if you think that you need the information or want to take part in the discussion, but you'll in any event receive right away a full summary of the discussion and of any decisions reached, together with a request for your